Good afternoon. We'll call the Senate Resources Committee meeting to order. This is Friday, February 17th, 2012. The time is approximately 3:35 on this Friday. We do have a quorum with us today. Present to my immediate left, co-chair, Senator Wagner. Senator Stedman is here. Senator McGuire, Senator French, Senator Wilikowski, myself, Senator Paskvan. Senator Stevens is excused. We do have in the audience Senator Giesel is here. I do not see any other elected officials. Today, the Senate Resources Committee has two items on the agenda. First, from approximately now until 5 p.m., we will continue our discussion with PFC Energy. We will take a closer look at progressivity. And include in that some specific modeling so that we get a little more refined understanding of what progressivity is and how it fits into the overall government take analysis. Beginning at approximately 5 p.m., then Senator Wagner will then chair the Resources Committee regarding Senate Bill 176, which is exemptions from mining tax. So we look forward to another productive Friday afternoon hearing, and given that, we welcome Tony Reinsch and Janik Mayer, but we need to have both of you put your names on the record and state your affiliation, and then let's continue with the PFC presentation.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Tony Reinsch. I'm Senior Director in the Upstream and Gas Group with PFC Energy.
I'm Janik Mayer, Manager in the Upstream and Gas Group at PFC Energy. And project manager for this particular engagement that we are undertaking for the Alaska State Legislature on fiscal terms reform through the LBNA committee. I will pick up, if I may, where we left off yesterday, perhaps to start by briefly recapping some of what we went through. Having talked about drivers for company behavior, and in particular, what are the thresholds and metrics and other things that determine how companies invest and in what regions companies invest. We talked yesterday about principles for fiscal reform, principles for a well-designed fiscal system in general, what makes for efficient or inefficient taxation, and arrived at the basic question of what is progressivity and how is it used and why is it used. We'll sort of pick up there, talk a little more about progressivity in principle from the perspective of an international comparison, first of all, briefly, of how progressivity is used in a number of different regimes, and then come back and look specifically at the ACES regime in Alaska, what progressivity looks like in the ACES regime in Alaska, and answer some of the questions that we were asked to address in terms of when it's said that progressivity in the ACES regime limits upside on oil price for companies. What is that true and what does it mean? And then look at what overall levels of both state and total government take look like for ACES in certain scenarios, including what would happen if particular caps were placed on progressivity. So that's what we'll cover today. We started, of course, yesterday with my favorite quote from Jean-Baptiste Colbert about the art of taxation being plucking the goose so as to get the most feathers with the least hissing, and said that if we were to interpret that in present-day terms, we'd say that taxation is about maximizing revenues, ideally, subject to two important constraints, efficiency and competitiveness. Efficiency being something we can measure in regards solely to ourselves, about how intelligently we are applying a tax, whether that tax distorts investment opportunities or only targets economic rent. And we talked a bit about the concept of economic rent and what that means. But then the idea that one could have a very efficient tax and still not have it necessarily be competitive. We concluded, with regard to sort of fixed percentage royalties, that these were very simple to administer regime, whose main strength lay in the simplicity of that administration, but also that a pure fixed percentage royalty is by and large inefficient, precisely because it means that at certain prices, at certain costs, it distorts investments. Certain projects will not go ahead under that sort of regime that might otherwise. And it's highly regressive in that as costs fall, as prices rise, government take decreases rather than staying neutral or increasing. And we said that in principle, a well-designed fiscal system, one that met Jean-Claude Colbert's test, is one that would ideally try to come closer to targeting economic rent. So taxing things that don't affect economic incentives, making sure that all projects that might otherwise be viable without the tax remain viable, but taking that portion of the proceeds that is pure economic rent. If we take that then as our starting point, one of the things that becomes apparent in thinking about things this way is that progressivity, if its aim is essentially in part to achieve this aim of targeting economic rent, can be used in a number of different ways and for a number of different purposes. In many instances internationally, it's used primarily not to create necessarily an overall progressive regime, but simply to partially or completely, in different cases, counterbalance other regressive elements of a fiscal regime. A regime that may, for historical reasons, have a long-standing fixed percentage royalty, for instance, may introduce another progressive element of that taxation or production-sharing regime to offset the regressive effect of that royalty. And we'll see in a number of slides, for instance, when we come to look at PPT, the precursor regime to ACES, that in many ways, as it was first proposed, as opposed to as it was enacted, it looked very much like something that was designed to create an overall neutral regime to counteract the regressive impact of the royalty. Other cases, however, progressivity is not used just to counteract the regressive effect of a royalty, but deliberately to create a progressive regime, one that as costs decrease, as oil prices increase, as there is more economic rent to be available, to make sure that the state's share of that economic rent isn't just necessarily a neutral or a fixed percent, but that in fact says to make these projects economic, that rent doesn't have to go to the company. We can design a regime that takes more of that for the state. Now, both of these approaches can yield fiscal taxation regimes that are entirely efficient if they are well designed and truly do just tax to the extent that it's possible to distinguish economic rent and not costs and ordinary return on capital. But regimes that combine both high levels of government take and high levels of progressivity may not necessarily, if well designed, may meet that first criteria we have of efficiency, but may not necessarily always meet our second criteria of competitiveness. And that's something that I think we should get into in a little more detail as we go through these slides. So if we look then at the question of how does progressivity work in different places? One of the things we concluded yesterday was that it works very differently in many different regimes. In particular, one can design a fiscal regime to use a wide range of metrics against which to be progressive. If we start with the simplest, for instance, probably the most widespread application of progressivity as a general principle in regimes around the world is still progressivity with regard to production levels. This started, we venture to say, in some of the earliest production sharing contracts that sought to increase levels of government take on more profitable fields, and remains to this day a key feature of production sharing contracts in many parts of the world, and is also used in creating variable royalty systems these days in many parts of the world. On screen here, we have a sort of snapshot of what Vietnam's fiscal terms look like. we can see there are two progressive elements to the Vietnam regime. Both of them progressive with regard to production amount. One is a royalty. One is the profit oil split itself. Both of those vary depending on how much is produced in a given asset. And in essence, the idea here, and this is sort of the idea that's common to all production varying progressivity, is it's using production level as a proxy for profitability. Now, of course, production level is a fairly poor proxy for profitability. It's one factor that will determine profitability. And if all of the assets in a given country have a very similar cost structure, then possibly one can tailor a regime like this to come close to targeting profitability through targeting production volume. But that approach has serious limitations. One of the things that you'll also see on the screen in terms of what's represented up there for Vietnam is that you'll notice there's a single regime sort of for pre-2010 fields of a single set of percentages that increase in terms of the royalty amount and that increase in terms of the level of government take in the profit split as production goes up. But that after 2010, there are sort of three different possibilities. And that reflects, you know, previously the vast majority of the asset base being fairly consistent shallow water fields. And then the government of Vietnam understanding that, well, if we want to go into deep water, those costs look very different. And so if we're going to have a structure that accommodates those, we need to think differently about how that's taxed with regard to production levels, precisely because we're not accurately targeting costs and profitability or rent, we're targeting production. And so that's led, in this case, to increasing complexity and different options within the regime, precisely because of the question of production being a poor proxy for profitability. The other thing to say about such systems is that they're almost always bracketed. So in this case, for instance, on one's first 20,000 barrels a day of production, if I produce at or below that level, I'm taxed 10% as a royalty, and I get to keep 50% or so of my profit. If I get up to 50,000 barrels a day, my royalty on those incremental additional barrels increases, and at some point my profit split also decreases. But it's only on the additional barrels above the threshold. It would be very rare to have, in fact, as far as I can think, unheard of to have a system like this that wasn't bracketed, where incremental production was all taxed at a higher rate just because one exceeded the threshold. In fact, that would be, in this case, precisely because production is a variable that's within the control of the contractor, would create incredibly undesirable incentives if that were the case, because, of course, one would never want to produce above a certain rate unless one could produce far enough above it to make that production worthwhile. Vietnam is just one example, and it's a production sharing contract example, but there are many other examples of regimes like this. As I say, many royalty-based regimes similarly use a price-based metric for progressivity. British Columbia in Canada, for instance, is one example of a regime that combines a production-based metric with a price-based metric to try and achieve a slightly better measure of progressivity that still is not profit-based, but comes a little closer to that. A number of other regimes specifically target price and only price with regard to progressivity. This is particularly common, for instance, in windfall profits taxes around the world. The idea being that we think all of the given assets in our country, we know that they will break even below a certain price, economically break even, including returning the normal return on capital to the investor. And so above that, we would like to take some increasing amount of the rents that come above that threshold. What we have up here, for example, is Venezuela's windfall profits tax that, you know, essentially there's a zero rate at oil prices below 40, at oil prices between $40 and $70. Again, in this bracketed approach, we have a 20% tax being applied on the revenue that came between the $40 and the $70 mark, while the revenue that came from the $40 price and below is untaxed, and then it steps up progressively to the point that, in this case in Venezuela, this particular aspect of the regime is highly progressive, so that at oil prices over $100, for that incremental part of the barrel that receives the price over $100, 95% of that is taken by the government.
Senator French has a question.
Yes. Just on this point in the bracketing and so forth.
Yeah.
You point out that you're about to point out that Alaska's system is an exception to the rule, but I skipped ahead a few slides. I noticed on slide 16 that Venezuela, despite bracketing, produces a government take at $100 a barrel that's virtually indistinguishable from our states. So you can get the same place just through different rates, bracketing or no bracketing.
Absolutely, that's entirely correct. I would never suggest, for instance, that the lack of bracketing in ACEs makes that in and of itself an invalid or an undesirable characteristic. The lack of bracketing in ACEs does do one thing, which is it makes, for those given levels of progressivity, of price that are set on which progressivity is based, it makes it a significantly more progressive regime than it would otherwise be. And the overall effect is that it increases government take. But one could achieve that structure with or without bracketing. It's just a question of where those brackets and where those price levels are set.
On slide 8, which is before us right now, is this dependent upon, for example, if the price truly stayed at $95 for the entire year, is all of that at 90%, or is each dollar?
It's each dollar.
Each dollar.
So in the case of the $100 threshold, if my oil price is $110, $10 of my $110 per barrel in revenue is being taxed at the 95% rate. Another $10 is being taxed at 90%. Another $20 is being taxed at 80%, and so on. And so that's the way the bracketing in that sort of system works.
Senator Willikowski.
Maybe I'll address this later, but just trying to understand why, with the argument that we hear all the time is our system takes away the upside.
Yeah.
And when I look at a system like this, this takes away the upside much more than our system would. And yet this is a country where, at least historically, we've had many of the majors going and investing. Can you explain why they would do that in this situation, but not in Alaska? I mean, are you able to explain that?
I am. Venezuela is probably in some ways more
Venezuela.
More Tony's cup of tea than mine, I might call on him to.
But we've heard examples of Venezuela. Argentina has a similar type of
I mean, Argentina, sense, in fact, was probably the next thing I was going to bring up on this slide, which is the extreme example, right, of one. The other thing one hears talk of in all this is high marginal tax rates under ACEs, and we'll talk a bit about marginal tax rates. Argentina, though, is the example of the highest marginal tax rate one can imagine, because it's essentially, at least for the windfall profit tax component of it, or the export tax component of it, zero until the price hits $42. And as soon as the price hits $42, the marginal rate is 100%, because $42 is the highest rate you can be paid for oil that you're exporting from Argentina. and in turn, I mean, the reason a system like that is implemented in a place like Argentina is not because that's a particularly efficient or sensible form of taxation. It's implemented because it's a market with high levels of regulation of all sorts of aspects of the domestic energy market, where domestic oil and gas prices are highly regulated. And so to allow those to stay at their limited levels, one needs a highly distorting regime like this, possibly, to achieve that, which also has a chilling effect then on investment. But
I think Venezuela is a particularly complex example, but I mean the impact of not only the windfall profits tax, but other changes in unilateral changes imposed by the government on the contractors resulted in virtually all of the majors and large companies leaving Venezuela, and they're unlikely to come back. The one company, the notable exception, being Chevron, who has stayed deeply vested in Venezuelan oil sands or ultra-heavy oil development, which is, a different kind of project development, and then it's what we would call a manufacturing process, much like integrated mined oil sands in Canada, where you don't carry exploration risk. You really are building, for all intents and purposes, a manufacturing plant, processing a very large known and recoverable resource. And in that environment, where you have no exploration risk to remaining in the equation, really what you have is a very large annuity generator being developed. You can afford to sort of maintain operations in this kind of a confiscatory fiscal environment, as people would look at that. But the companies left, but they left for other reasons. I mean, there you have a very aggressive national oil company that was, you know, you had mandated operatorship taken away from the company. So Venezuela had a number of moving parts that resulted in that fairly significant change in their competitive landscape. It certainly wasn't all the fiscal terms.
Senator Stedman has a question.
Just two questions. One of them is, what would be the marginal tax rate in this example if the price of oil was 110?
The marginal tax rate in this case is 95%.
Right. And then if we go and we look at Venezuela, isn't pretty much all of the Western oil companies pretty much out of Venezuela except for Chevron? And if we put the Chevron leaseholders up on the screen, it would be almost I hate America. I mean, wouldn't that be reflected in there?
In the marginal tax rate?
No. The companies in Venezuela that they're working today.
Well, I mean, the Repsol, Statoil, a number of companies are positioned, but all in the same type of asset. Repsol probably being the one unique or differentiated in that they have also pursued very large-scale gas exploration and commercialization with an eye to LNG. But Repsol is also a Spanish-speaking quasi or former national oil company itself, and has staked a claim as a linguistic leader, I guess, in the upstream development in South America generally. So they have a different sort of incentive and strategy towards the continent. But the other companies, I mean, there's no question, under a different set of fiscal terms and a different positioning by the national oil company, Venezuela would attract much more foreign direct investment than is the case today. But you can argue that that's also been delivered on the part of the current administration.
To move on to our next possible metric of progressivity, as is commonly used in a number of regimes around the world, one more sophisticated approach to targeting economic rent, at least a little more directly, is, instead of focusing just on price, just on production, just on cost, to look at the process over time by which projects recover their capital, and to assess projects on how far they've recovered their capital, how much over and above the spending, the total spending that was required, both capital and operating cost, in fact, in this case, they have gone. And as they go further above simple, undiscounted, full recovery, taxing them at a progressively higher rate. So, for instance, if we look at the 1997 and beyond, still in place by and large to this day, production sharing contract for Malaysia. It was a new contract that was introduced precisely to be more efficient in this sense of increasing rates of taxation once costs have been recovered. It's based on a metric called R-factor. The R in R-factor, as far as I think anyone knows, simply stands for ratio. And in principle, one could have an R-factor on all sorts of different things. Most commonly, R-factor, as the term is used, refers to the ratio of cumulative revenues from a project to cumulative costs, both operating and capital. And so when one has an R-factor of 1, what one is saying is that on an entirely undiscounted cash flow basis, one has fully recovered the costs, the pure undiscounted accounting costs of the project. And as R-factor increases, yeah, an R-factor of 2, I've taken those basic costs and doubled them in my revenue. So the basic idea behind a regime like Malaysia's is that at an R factor below one, so well before cost recovery, I have a relatively high limit on the amount of revenues in any given year that I can count towards my cost recovery. And of the profit oil above that that is split, I can keep 80% of it to begin with. As my R factor rises above one and towards significantly higher numbers, that profit split will go from 80% down as low as 30% in terms of what I'm allowed to keep. So it's quite a backloaded regime. It allows quick cost recovery for the contractor. And in that sense, by doing so, improves their economics on metrics like IRR and NPV, but allows quite a higher level of government take by saying, once you've recovered your costs, we'll take progressively more and more and more of the take.
Senator French, then Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're not about to throw over our system in favor of this one. I know you're not suggesting that, but by way of comparison, again, I flip back to page 16. I see that Malaysia taxes, you know, at a relative government take at a rate almost identical to Alaska's. So I guess my comparison question would be, how would I look to the investment level? Because that's really a lot of us driving our concern here is the investment level. How would I go to the Malaysian investment level and compare that with Alaska? It's just an interesting question, you know, sort of how do you hold that equal across two very different locations?
Tony, you want to take that one?
Well, I think the question really is how the, you know, how are projects defined and is the capital continuing to be attracted to these locations? What you do see in Malaysia, for example, is, or what we see in Malaysia is a sharper definition of new project. So if you have a field that you've been producing with primary and perhaps secondary waterflood techniques and production, you know, and that field has matured, and now it's time to introduce enhanced oil recovery, that will be presented to the government as a new project development, falling back to now an R factor of one for the incremental production. So you can end up with the introduction of levels of complexity in a regime like this as the company and the government now move the debate more to what constitutes a new project and what constitutes new capital expenditure versus maintenance capital on an existing mature project that perhaps shouldn't impact the R factor. So in some respects, the dialogue between the government and the client and the contractor, the regulator and the company, or the government and the company, just changes somewhat in terms of defining their what constitutes
new. Maybe I can, just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chairman. I guess my question is just a little more sort of blunt and basic. If I wanted to compare the investment levels in Malaysia versus the investment level in Alaska, would I just look at the number of barrels produced, the decline curve, and the relative capex, you know, and sort of reduce that down to a per barrel amount of capex? Is that at least one way to go about seeing, you know, is this R factor method producing a more robust level of investment or less robust, or is that too simple?
My expectation would be that on a dollar per BOE basis, what you would see reflected is the higher, just the more remote nature and the more difficult operating environment in Alaska versus Malaysia.
It's just going to overcome any taxation differences.
It may, but I can't say for sure on that. But you see that bias.
I'm teasing. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just kind of curious, you know, Alaska in Pacific, you know, when we have roughly 600,000 barrels of production, how would we go about implementing an R factor model when we have such an aging field, which some would argue the, you know, a lot of the costs are well beyond their time horizon?
I'd agree. I mean, some of this material is covered in this sense because we've specifically asked about how progressivity works in different parts of the world. I certainly wouldn't suggest that R factor is particularly a model to be recommended for Alaska, and in particular, exactly as you say, one of the things that implementing an R factor system relies on is an accurate historical accounting for costs. In that sense, it's something that's much easier to do point forward than it is for existing mature assets. to move on one slide further, another variation of this sort of idea, again, sort of focusing with each of these steps more explicitly on taxing returns above a baseline normal return on capital. One of the ways in which some regimes choose to do this, and this is a relatively new inclination in the design of fiscal systems, is to, in some instances, for instance, focus explicitly on a metric like IRR, internal rate of return of a project, and set progressivity rates in terms of taxation under the fiscal structure specifically based on a particular IRR that may have been achieved. So, for instance, in the shallow water Angola, any project that is yet to make a 20% rate of return, and Tony, I think, talked a bit yesterday about sort of 20 to 25% probably being a reasonable hurdle rate for investment in places like West Africa, where there's significantly more above ground risk than there might be elsewhere. So that at rates below that, a contractor's share of profit oil may be quite high, in this case 60%. But that as IRR rises above those sorts of hurdle rates, the contractor share gets progressively less and less. And in this case, we have a slightly different regime for deep water than we have for shallow. But the idea is the same, just in this case, providing even more to the contractor at low rates of return to make the economics of the investment from a hurdle rate perspective more desirable.
We have a question from Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When we initially did this progressivity mechanism in PPT, we had contemplated and discussed doing it on a rate of return basis, but we couldn't get the information to do a rate of return. We thought it would be a fairer methodology than a price base. So if you, how would you implement this into an aging field?
I think in many ways the same thing applies to what I said for R factor, which is that it's a much easier system to apply point forward than it is historically speaking. I think it's a system that tends to be seen much more in production sharing contracts than in tax royalty regimes, and part of the reason for that is production sharing contracts tend more frequently to exist in places that either have a very active national oil company that is itself involved in the development of the project and therefore in the assessment of the project economics, or a highly developed oil ministry. One of the other comments I made on this front yesterday was that there are many parts of the world, for instance, that may have very little government capacity anywhere else in the entire rest of the government, but may have a highly functioning petroleum ministry. And having one of those two things helps you to do this in a way that if you don't have that capacity, it's very difficult to do.
Just to speak to the actual application of a system like this, however, in Tanzania, Mozambique, in West Africa as well, these are fairly young jurisdictions where organizations like the International Finance Corporation, World Bank, IMF, were very much involved in supporting developments of these regimes. And to make this operational, the companies were required and are today required to give their models to third-party auditors, whether they be Commonwealth Secretariat or Norwegian Petroleum Directorate or somebody who takes those models in-house and takes them apart and puts them back together and verifies that, yes, these are defensible IRR calculations, and on that basis, the annual audits are done. So, you know, it very much becomes a matter of being able to review and audit the materials being provided by the companies. So a level of sophistication and trust there.
Thank you. Please continue.
The final comment I would make on regimes of this sort is that in the same way as we saw with regard to price progressivity, the sort of extreme example in the case of Argentina, where progressivity is essentially 100% after $42 a barrel, the extreme example in cases like this is the shift in certain jurisdictions away from simple production sharing to things like risk service contracts, which really actually fundamentally in that case changed the role of the International Oil Company from being a risk-bearing partner to being a system, in fact, where government takes the risk and the International Oil Company is guaranteed a particular rate of return, but no more. So, for instance, in the case of a few of the new sort of marginal field developments in Malaysia, Petronas there, as the National Oil Company, has put out a number of fields on a risk service contract basis, saying we will guarantee a certain rate of return for you, for you to come in and spend capital and do this, but the oil is all ours, it's not yours. That fundamentally changes the nature of the relationship. And I think that's worth pointing out in as far as thinking about how progressive a regime is, and that at some point, as well as progressivity increases further and further, and government takes more and more of the rent, one is moving away from a model that says government and the private sector is a partner here who's come in to bear risk and be rewarded for that, and more to a reallocation of risk and reward toward the government.
Senator Stedman.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Are you aware of any areas in the world where the industry felt that the tax structure was a little bit too heavy and asked the jurisdiction to look at the rate of return methodology to bring the government split more in line with what they would like to see?
I'm not specifically aware of examples of contractors seeking out a rate of return methodology. That it's possible, but I'm not aware of an example.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, through the chair. In Malaysia, when you talk about the government bearing a larger share of the risk, and as a result, then negotiating with oil companies for a guaranteed rate of return and nothing more, what do you mean by the state bearing the risk? Can you give me an example of the kinds of things that Malaysia does to share in that risk?
For instance, if I say to a contractor that we will guarantee you a 15, 17, whatever percent rate of return for you to come here, spend the capital and produce from these fields, that guarantee works on the one hand to limit the upside at an absolute maximum, but it also works to guarantee that absolute maximum, right? If it turns out this is such a dreadfully marginal field that it can't even achieve an 18% rate of return, I'm still on the hook to provide that to the contractor.
And if I might just follow up through the chair. And my assumption was that rate, obviously, we'd be paid by the government, and so that's a built-in sharing of the risk. But are there other things, credits, loan incentives, loan guarantees? What are the kinds of things that Malaysia does in terms of partnering for development of those fields or supporting of the production costs? Anything?
In terms of those specific sorts of things that you mentioned, which, you know, obviously are particular factors of the ACES regime, not that I'm aware of.
On the other hand, the government can share in risk, is my point.
Yeah, absolutely.
Physicians, loans, tax credits. We do a lot of tax credits.
Well, and certainly, I mean, in that sense, the big way in which the Malaysian government shares in risk is by having a large and active NOC, a national oil company, that is an active equity participant in the development of those assets. So, yes.
Thank you.
To move on to one sort of final look at how this is done in a number of places around the world, I thought I would use the example of Australia. I'd use it for a number of reasons. One, you may be able to tell from my accent that I happen to have grown up there. It's an OECD jurisdiction. It's also one that in some ways follows a method of taxation that is, of all the sorts that we've followed so far, most similar to ACES, in that it's most explicitly a profit-based taxation regime. But it's one that I think, and I hope I say this objectively rather than because it's Australia, is I think actually particularly thoughtful and clever in the way that the system is designed. It's designed by a couple of very famous economists. And it's the only system, in fact, that I'd say I've ever come across that really does explicitly target just economic rent rather than profit, including the ordinary return on capital. And in that sense, as far as I'm aware, I would think that this should be one of the least distorting and most efficient taxation regimes in the world, whether or not it's competitive. It's a very simple regime compared to many. It essentially has one single tax at one single rate, other than corporate income tax. It has the petroleum resource rent tax. It's levied at a 40% rate. That 40% tax is levied not on profit, but on the cash flow of the asset. The basic idea of the system is to try to come as close as possible without establishing a national oil company and actually directly participating in an asset, in a project, to replicate the economics of a direct equity stake in the project. So on the one hand, government receives 40% of the cash flows. On the other hand, the basic idea is that government also contributes 40% of the costs to developing the project. Now, from the perspective both of politics and of timing of revenues and managing a government budget, having government actually directly contribute 40% of that capital can be very difficult. And so the idea is, instead of directly contributing at the time 40% of the capital, the idea is that the 40% of costs that the government should be on the hook for get recovered from the government later through by being taken out of the revenues that would otherwise go in taxes to the government. But those revenues are inflated each year by a rate that's essentially equivalent to the cost of capital for the company. It's set in relation to the government bond rate, but it's the government bond rate plus a certain percentage. And so by doing so, the economics, in fact, on a net present value basis, are identical to saying, well, the government puts in 40% of the costs and government takes out 40% of the benefits. And so in that sense, it's the only regime that I've ever seen that really does get to the heart of taxing economic rent rather than other things that are a better or worse proxy for economic rent. And precisely because it's a very simple system, no royalty, no other taxes, just single rate, 40% petroleum rent resource tax, and then corporate income tax after that, it's one of the simplest, most transparent and rent-targeting regimes that I've seen anywhere. One thing, again, on this question of sharing risk versus reward and what happens as one increases progressivity, one can conduct a brief thought experiment, which is to say, well, what would happen if one set the PRRT rate for Australia to 100%? Doing so essentially would be government saying, okay, the model here is no longer that the private sector is coming in here to take risk and benefit from that. The model here is that we are outsourcing the development of this resource to the company. The company, we will effectively provide 100% of the costs, and we will get 100% of the revenues, and the company is just here as a service provider to implement what we want. There are many reasons why the Australian government hasn't chosen to go down that path, but one of them is if one thinks about, well, what are the incentives that creates for a company? If the system is set up so that government is paying 100% of the costs, but government is getting 100% of the benefit, but it's the private sector that is actually doing all the work, there's very little incentive for the private sector to minimize the costs involved in what it's undertaking. I think that's an important point to make, for instance, as we come to talk in a little bit about high marginal tax rate under ACEs, because in principle, high marginal rates at times imply the same thing, that you know, if I face, at a given point under ACEs, a 90 or higher percent marginal tax rate, that doesn't particularly affect my project economics, that doesn't particularly affect the decision I make as to whether that passes a hurdle rate of return or not. But if my decision is I need to install a new gas processing facility and I could spend $1 billion and get a pretty good one that will do the job, or I could spend $1.5 billion and get a really good one, if I have a 95% marginal tax rate, then the actual incremental difference in the spending on those two is very small. And it may be worth spending the $1.5 billion because I don't really bear the full anything like the full cost of that in a way that it wouldn't if I were having to pay that full $1.5 billion with no tax benefit for doing so.
Senator.
Maybe that gets into the discussion, Mr. Chairman, that we've had in the past on gold plating. And maybe you could.
Gold plating is the exact term for what I'm describing.
And then maybe you could kind of give us, you know, your guys' opinion on when you, you know, start getting close to the gold plating or in the gold plating arena, and when you're not. Clearly, if it's somebody else's money, it's gold plated, but it's your money, it's not. But I mean, something a little more definitive than that. You're using the 95%, but can you give us a little better feel for where we should be a little more cautious and maybe an area where we shouldn't worry so much?
I don't have a particular marginal rate in mind that I would suggest is where gold plating is cut off, where gold plating becomes a serious problem. Certainly, I would have thought that at sort of rates of 85-90% and above in terms of marginal return, it's an increasing issue just because of the relatively small share of marginal capital that is truly borne by the party making the investment decision.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just follow up. We've had previous testimony that showing our current system under high prices, maybe 200 plus, and we could actually be in a negative, go over 100%. Have you guys played with those numerics north of 200 can you comment on that, or maybe at a later time?
Might comment on that at a later time if we could. I've certainly looked at the impact of ACEs under high price environments. I've seen high marginal rates of return. I haven't seen anything over 100%. Oh, actually, no. That's not entirely true. In high price environments, purely looking at production tax value. So at production tax values of north of 200, yes, you get rates of over 100%. I would like to look into that question further before answering definitively, but certainly on the basis of the analysis that I've done so far, I have not seen a price level at which marginal rates for the ACES system as a whole, rather than just production tax value, go above 100%.
Right, Mr. Chairman, I think I was referring more to the production tax value than the marginal rate. But we can look at that in more detail later as we
walk through the system. So to come back to where we started in thinking about this analysis, we said at the start that we could have an efficient regime that sought not to distort project economics, not to make marginal projects uneconomic just through the imposition of a tax, but that tax regime may or may not be competitive, and that similarly we could have a competitive regime in as far as it has a relatively low rate of government take, but a distorting structure that otherwise means that marginal projects are unviable. And that the principle that one would ideally seek to follow is having one that is neither inefficient and distorting, nor is other rates of total government take so high as to be uncompetitive. We've focused a lot in what we've talked on so far about progressivity on the efficiency side of the question. And in looking specifically at ACEs and at some international comparisons for ACEs and some looks at where the system has come from and what it might look like under certain modifications, we get a little bit more into the competitiveness territory. So we were talking just now about average and marginal rates and what high marginal rates do in terms of incentives for gold plating. I'm certain there's been a lot of discussion in the entire context of ACEs and the strengths or possible problems of the system, this notion of high marginal tax rates. And I think it's certainly important to understand that ultimately it's average or effective rates, not marginal rates, that drive project economics at a given price level, that determine if a project meets a hurdle rate of return for capital or not. But the fact that that's the case doesn't mean that marginal rates are not a useful piece of information in understanding certain key characteristics of a fiscal system. One thing that we can understand from marginal rates is understanding the interaction between marginal and average rates can actually give us a useful way of benchmarking progressivity of different regimes. If we look, for instance, at this graph of average and marginal rates just for the production tax component of the ACES regime, it's graphed on the bottom not against ANS oil price but simply against production tax value. Of course, we see what I imagine is common to many here, the high rate of progressivity for PTV up until $90 to $2.50, and then the lower rate of PTV after that threshold. And we see a very high level of marginal tax up until that point, a sudden drop, and then a slower rate of increase. In terms of understanding the relationship between those two things, if I think about, and this again sort of comes back to where we started yesterday with sort of microeconomics 101, as long as that marginal rate line is above the average rate line, I have a progressive regime. My marginal rate is above my average rate, it's pulling my average rate up over time. If that marginal line were below my average, it would be pulling my average rate down as prices increased and I'd have a regressive regime. So by subtracting one from the other, I, on the one hand, my average take tells me overall how much of the proceeds government is getting, but my marginal rate tells me something then about the progressivity. So if I look at the difference between the two, if I subtract my average from my marginal rate, I've, by the way, on the next slide, amended things because I think those two terms are the wrong way around on the slides as they are printed. My apologies for that. But if I subtract the average from the marginal, I can sort of create an index to understand, well, just how progressive is a regime at a given price level.
If before we turn to the next page, yeah. I think for many in the viewing audience, it would be useful to define the term gold plating and what context that you're using that in and why you use the term perverse incentives when talking about high marginal rates and this term that we'll define called gold plating.
Sure. So that term gold plating comes sort of at the heart of my previous comments about high marginal rates and the incentives or lack of incentives for companies to exercise cost control in certain circumstances. The term gold plating in that sense describes exactly what I was describing further, of the sense of I need a new facility, I might be able to spend $1 billion and get a facility that will do the job to the best cost-benefit analysis. Or I could spend $1.5 billion and get an even better facility, but one that doesn't, in and of itself, justify the extra $500 million in expenses. If I face a 95% marginal rate of tax, my incentives may be, in fact, to go for the $1.5 billion facility because I'm only, after I've accounted for the effects of my changed taxation rate in addressing that investment, I'm only actually paying a small portion of that cost. And so if there's a very small additional benefit to me from making that additional investment, it might be worth it since I'm not the one paying the full cost of it.
If one were to combine the concept of gold plating and high marginal rates with Alaska's capital credit, what is the cumulative effect of that?
I think the cumulative effect of all of that is probably toward increasing costs. Certainly, it's not a system that strongly incentivizes cost control, quite the opposite.
Senator Willikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you see, in any research you've done, do you see any evidence of gold plating in our Alaska system? And let me just preface that by saying my understanding of the system is it really taxes, it's not so much a profits tax as it's taxing your cash flow. And if you look at the profits that have been made by the industry, $30 billion in profits that they've taken, it would appear that they are taking the profits and not, they're certainly reinvesting. Have you seen evidence, I mean, based on the financial numbers that you've seen of gold plating here in Alaska?
I think gold plating is, by definition, very hard to identify. If one is not, and again, this comes back to the question of incentives and information asymmetry. If one is not the individual actually making purchasing decisions and deciding whether one needs the billion or the billion and a half dollar facility, and doing that cost-benefit analysis, it's very hard firsthand to know whether that's going on or not. I think one can look at the incentives and say the incentives might encourage it. I certainly have not looked anywhere near enough detail to go further than that.
If I could just, we talked, the economists that we used during ACES talked a lot about the advantages of a high marginal tax rate. And the philosophy at the time was what we were seeing was companies in harvest mode, which I think has been confirmed by these hearings we've had. Taking the money, though, and reinvesting it, taking it out of Alaska and reinvesting it in other places around the world. And what we've seen since we've passed ACE, and so the rationale for the higher marginal tax rate was, at a higher marginal tax rate, it will incentivize reinvestment in the state of Alaska. And since we've passed ACEs, we have seen all-time highs every single year in capital investment, virtually all-time highs in operating investment as well. Are those positive things that you would expect to find out of a high marginal tax rate? Would you agree with that philosophy that it encourages reinvestment in the basin?
Certainly, I think it's a very specific set of carrots and sticks, and those carrots and sticks are set up to provide significant benefits from reinvesting. Whether those benefits are sufficient to compensate for the overall high level of government take is another question. I don't have a conclusive answer to that at this point because we are in the process of a detailed modelling exercise. We'll put up some slides on the screen shortly that show levels of government take and a couple of other metrics for ACEs for a generic, relatively low cost asset, sort of akin to what one might think of developing a smaller new Prudhoe Bay today. But just looking at the context of a generic asset gives one only a very limited view on things. Part of the reason that we are undertaking a much more detailed modelling exercise where we model out the entire base portfolio for each company and look at possible new investments for each company and then try to understand what the economics of those look like under ACEs, given the benefits from deductions from capital credits, is precisely because one really needs to get to that level of detail to really understand how the system works and to understand whether those incentives are sufficient to overcome the overall level of high take or not.
Senator Stedman.
I just need to comment about the comment my colleague just made. Dealing with a high marginal rate, if you have a really high marginal rate policy, would encourage reinvestment. I think it's a more complex issue than that. You've got credits up front to encourage capital to stay here, and then as you distort both your marginal rate, accelerate your marginal rate up and accelerate your credits up, all of a sudden you've got distortions all over the place and the whole thing collapses. So not literally collapses, but collapses in its ability to function at more moderate levels. So I think there's the issue of the theory, and then there's the whole issue of the implementation and the results of the implementation. But so we can explore that, I guess, in further detail as we get into the more advanced modeling and issues like that when we work with the credits and the marginal issue. But if I could, Mr. Chairman, get away from the tutorial and get to a question or a request. Here we've got on the chart the production tax value, and I was just wondering when we do these charts if we could get a reference on the price of oil I think in like in 13, we're looking at like a cost base of maybe $70 by the about $40, excuse me, upstream and downstream, about $40. So it makes it easier for folks at home to reference the chart, because people just gear right into the price of oil, not the production tax value. And even in the comments that some people make when they're speaking to two groups, and they'll target this 9250 and as the high, you know, do data mining, grab the 9250 for the highest marginal tax rate. And the people in the audience think, are left with the impression that's $92.50 in oil and we're above that. And, you know, the world's going to end and call your legislator right away. So it'd be nice if we, you know, we could do that and help the public at home drill in, and also help us when we look at the charts, gearing in on some of the cost factors embedded in the production tax line.
If I could respond to that very briefly, Mr. Chairman, I would say, in particular, I think, Senator, you're absolutely correct to point out the imperative of distinguishing between an analysis that's done on the basis of production tax value and an analysis that's on the basis of oil price. In a case like this, this shows us something specific about a specific small portion of the ACES system. This isn't the ACES system in its entirety. And even just thinking about the inputs into production tax value, there are many different possible variables. Cost, of course, is the major one. And cost over time and how cost is phased over time is a major one. So in many ways, the minute we do this analysis on the basis of oil price rather than production tax value, it's suddenly no longer a nice, clear-cut, simple graph like this. It's a much fuzzier picture.
Although maybe just an idea that, and I understand exactly what you're saying, that, you know, pull the cost out of the chart, you know, show us production tax value. Maybe we could even have a double x-axis. So we can have the current prices underneath or something like that, just to help people reference back and forth, because it is kind of a two-edged sword when you're trying to, you know, get the concept across. And
Understood. Thank you.
Just for purposes of timing, we have approximately 20 minutes left until.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I will try to get through the remaining slides with haste. To take that basic point I was making about subtracting away the average from the marginal rate to get a basic idea of progressivity, if we do that exercise for a range of regimes, and this is sort of using a standard global international model that the PFC uses for a number of purposes, a couple of things emerge. One point to make about the analysis in terms of the way this was done, this is not the way some other fiscal systems comparisons are done on the basis of a single reference field. This is an analysis that we do where we put through assets that we identify in our database of assets as typical for a particular regime. And so in some cases we may be comparing a relatively low-cost field to a relatively high-cost field, but that's because those are developments that are typical of that area and that regime. And what we're looking to get to is the question of what does government take look like, given the nature of the assets in a given jurisdiction in different places. Here, if we do that exercise of subtracting the average from the marginal take, we can see that the world is sort of split up into progressive and regressive regimes, at least at the $100 price level, with a few neutral ones in the middle. And that of those, Alaska is certainly not the most progressive, but it is among the more or the most progressive regimes around. If we do the same exercise at $140 a barrel, that becomes even more the case. And certainly it is the most progressive regime of any in the OECD and among the highest that we've seen.
And we just, I guess, looking down your chart further, if we can look, use that chart or whatever one, but U.S., Texas, North Dakota, and Louisiana, they're all regressive?
Precisely.
Gulf of Mexico, is that correct?
That's correct, Senator, and that is precisely because they are largely royalty-dominated regimes, and as we've seen previously, royalties are inherently a regressive taxation measure.
Right, royalty and taxes. Property tax, income tax, those two combinations, correct?
And of those, royalty tax and property tax, in particular, are the most regressive components.
And I think, as I recall, Mr. Chairman, I know we always get short of time. As I recall, when we did the initial review of PPT, we had a regressive system. And that's what created the interest in the legislature to insert a progressivity measure to at least, in theory, get us in the middle of this chart. And we ended up where we ended up, you know, over a couple of gyrations, but we definitely did not want to be from the center down.
And
it's for historical reference, whatever it's worth.
Senator Sturton, I absolutely agree, and in fact, when we come to looking specifically at ACES at a range of price levels, one of the first things we will see in a few charts time is an analysis of PPT as it was originally proposed by the executive rather than as it was enacted, and it in fact looks, it's a very neutral regime precisely because the progressivity is almost exactly enough to counter the regressive nature of the royalty. Since we are addressing that question of overall competitiveness of a regime, regardless of the question of whether it is efficient or not, one of the things that's also useful to do is, again, through this same sort of global model benchmarking exercise, have a look at where Alaska ranks among the range of countries that we're able to do the analysis on. Again, it is relatively high in the deck. It's not the highest OECD country. I think at $100 a barrel, Norway has that honor. But it's the second highest OECD country. And if we look at the regimes that are above, they tend to be, by and large, production sharing contract regimes with some of the higher levels of government take that we see around. If we do the analysis at $140 a barrel, that's even more the case. In this particular instance, Alaska then is about equal with Norway.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilkowski.
Just a question on how you calculate government take. Are you taking the actual amount that is being paid in a given year and then figuring out what is actually paid, or rather are you using the general tax rates and assuming that the full tax is being paid?
The basic methodology is, first of all, to start with this concept of divisible income. We put this up on a slide yesterday. Divisible income being all of the revenues that the project creates, less its costs, so less capital and operating costs. That's the divisible income that the project creates that can be distributed either to the private company owning and operating the project or to the government. If we then take away the after-tax cash flow, based on what the model suggests, that goes to the contractor, everything else, in some form or another, goes to the government, and that's the absolute government take. That may go to the government through royalty, that may go to the government through property taxes, that may go to the government through profit sharing. There's a range of ways in which that can occur, but that's all government take, and if we put that government take and over the divisible income, we then have a percentage.
And I'll get into this at some point. I know we're short on time, but for instance, are you assuming that in this government take figure, the companies are paying a full corporate income tax of 9.4%?
The model probably, in most cases, certainly, for instance, the Alaska model, uses a 9.4% tax rate, yes.
And if the actual number was much less than that, because the companies, for instance, are allowed to write off bad, their lower profits in other regions, I don't think there's anybody in Alaska that pays 9.4%. So I think these numbers are not are probably much lower for Alaska, would be my guess.
That may be the case. I would suggest that that may also be the case in a number of other regions as well. So the effect is not necessarily solely on Alaska, if that's the case. I'd also say that in that sense, for instance, state income tax is one of the smallest components of government take. And in that sense, a percentage or two off that will have an impact here, but will be much less than a percentage off the government take that's seen up here.
A little under 15 minutes, so we could power forward.
Okay. We have on the screen now in front of us a few graphs of what PPT, the predecessor regime to ACES, looked like, not as it was enacted, but as it was originally proposed by the executive. It speaks precisely to the point that Senator Stedman was making earlier about a progressive regime that was designed with enough progressivity to counteract the regressive nature of the royalty, but that leaves, relatively speaking, an overall neutral regime. It's very slightly regressive, but overall it's almost spot-on neutral, at least under the assumptions that we see here. It has, around a 60% total government take, almost entirely across the price deck. If we look at PPT as it was enacted, so we take the base rate, but then add the progressivity element and the other changes that were made to PPT between the time it was proposed and the time it was enacted, we see now significantly greater progressivity of the regime. We see government take rising from that sort of flat 60% level across all price levels to one that sort of rises to a peak of about 74%, given the assumptions of the particular asset type that we're looking at. And we see on the top left, as a result, a decline as well in some of the NPV and IRR metrics for this sort of generic representative asset at which we're looking. If we then look at ACES as it was proposed, a relatively marginal difference between ACES as it was proposed by the executive versus PPT as it had been enacted by the legislature. The primary difference comes at relatively low prices because progressivity is at a lower rate, but it kicks in at a lower threshold as well, and that raises government take somewhat lower in the price deck. If we then look at ACES as it was actually enacted, we again see a significant increase in the progressivity of the system and a significant increase in the overall government take.
Mr. If I could just, what parameters as far as costs are you imposing on this, and what would increase costs due to the total GT column?
Increased costs would certainly reduce that figure, Mr. Chairman. This is an analysis that's been prepared on the basis of a lower cost development on the Alaska North Slope. Not, I think, on the basis of the cost numbers that I have from Department of Revenue for assets like Prudhoe Bay, not inconsistent with some of those, but certainly much lower than I would anticipate for some of the newer developments like Ugarit, for instance. So from recollection, I think we were using slightly over $8 per barrel in operating costs for this model, around $5 a barrel in pure maintenance capex, and then probably a similar amount in development capex for this sort of asset. So not inconsistent with some of the figures that we see for Prudhoe Bay, but probably less than we would see for some new developments. And we can certainly, for instance, produce analysis like this on the basis of a higher cost asset as well, if that's of interest.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. Again, just on the numbers, let's look at $100 a barrel oil. You've got a 16% royalty, and you've got a 39% production tax. And the numbers, I think, that are more accurate are 12.5% for the royalty and a production tax of around 28%. Those are the effective numbers that we've seen from the governor's office time and time again. And I realize that the federal tax flexes with that, but tell me where I'm wrong.
what you need to think about in terms of those percentages is that these are percentages that sum up to a total government take number. So it's about saying, of that, in this case, at $230 a barrel, 83% government take, what of that 83% comes from each of these? So, for instance, at $40 a barrel, I see royalty at 30%. That's not saying there's a 30% royalty. There is a flat, 12.5% royalty being applied in this model. It's saying that of the 30% government take, of the, in this case, 60-something percent government take, half of that is coming from royalty. And it's because royalty is 12.5% of the gross revenues of the project. It's not 12.5% of the divisible income. It's much more than that. It's 30% of the divisible income.
Senator French, did you have a question?
I do. These CapEx and OpEx numbers are significantly lower than the ones I recall from a revenue source book. I don't have my copy here. But I'm just wondering, if they're not from the revenue source book, where are they from?
They come from a number of things. These are, again, we will be getting into a much more detailed modeling exercise looking at how different cost fields look in the context of different portfolios. The costs here are not out of keeping with the data that I have from Department of Revenue on costs at the lower end of the spectrum, for instance, for say, a Prudhoe Bay. And that has been a key informing factor in terms of putting these costs into the model.
So the commissioner or one of his deputies gave you these numbers?
The numbers, these specific numbers, no, but I do have numbers where the department is able to release them, which is in cases that there are more than three working interest partners in an asset on general levels of operating and capital costs. Now, those numbers one needs to make a few adjustments for because, for instance, you know, I can see from those numbers what operating costs are in any given year. The capital costs I need to find a way of distinguishing between what's maintenance capex and what is capital that's going for incremental development. And so some of those adjustments have been made to these figures, but that's the source of at least of the basis of the assumptions.
Just one last question, and I know we're running short on time, but I guess I would look forward to see maybe 20 runs using new fields, heavy oil fields, Prudhoe Bay fields, because I think it's helpful to see Prudhoe there as composed to the takes and more challenged fields and higher costs. So this is just, we're just getting started, and we're still getting to know each other, but I look forward to lots more runs. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman has a question.
Yeah, I think, Mr. Chairman, it would be interesting for us to take a look at these cost numbers as we go forward, because I think in 2013, the numbers in the source book is about $13.60 a barrel for the operating and about $17.50 for CapEx. So depending on, depending on if you're going to use net or gross of royalty barrels on that particular number. But anyway, that's substantially different, total of about $31 to $18. So we'll have to sort through some of that stuff because the revenue source book is what we have access to more easily is a combination of everything.
Right.
So we don't have the ability to parse out, and that's what we're looking for you guys to help us with.
Exactly. And from those aggregate numbers, one can say, well, what does an average field look like? But actually, no asset and no company portfolio looks like an average field. This was an exercise to say, well, what does it look like for some of the lower cost, more mature assets? But that's very different to what it looks like for some of the higher cost ones.
And I think that's where some of the problem is surfacing now is we look at, like, the fall 2011 revenue source book, we see a homogenized industry. We don't see the spectrum of the industry. And so I think it's well taken that we need to understand maybe more specific fields and understand their operation within this overall fiscal system.
I very much hope that the work that we're doing on an ongoing basis in terms of coming up with a more detailed and granular model assists in that exercise. To address this question that was asked about, well, how does ACES limit the upside of high oil prices for an oil and gas company. Some of that I think we've seen on the preceding slides in terms of looking at those price decks and the escalating level of government take across those price decks. Another way of looking at this is to say, well, maybe we could graph net present value of a project over a range of different price decks for some of these different regimes. And we can see, for instance, how that changes over time under PPT as was proposed versus enacted, ACES as proposed versus ACES as enacted. And I think very graphically there you see this question of limitation of upside. Whether capping upside is necessarily in all circumstances a bad thing is another question. Capping of upside is in many ways something that comes to the heart of what we've been talking about in terms of taxing economic rent. But one way that one could seek to quantify this would be to say, well, we could take a probabilistic approach to the oil price. Rather than simply saying, I want to know what the economics of this field look like at $60 or $80 or $100 a barrel, I have a probability distribution curve, and here is a very sort of crude, not a continuous probability function, but a discrete set of distributions. If I take that probability curve and I say, well, this is what my NPV looks like under each of those different prices, I could say, well, what's my expected value in this on this probabilistic basis for this asset under each of these regimes? And we can see in the legend on the right of the graph that expected value falling as the upside potential is curbed by high progressivity. That isn't the same as saying that by curbing the benefit of high upside, one affects the economics that determine the things that my colleague Tony was talking about yesterday in terms of meeting hurdle rates or some of the other key metrics under which capital is allocated. But it's one way of understanding the limitations on price upside that high progressivity creates. Finally, to answer the question of the committee on what are the impacts of changing nothing else about the ACES system other than the level at which progressivity is capped. So we've kept in this analysis everything else about the system, the progressivity coefficients, identical, and simply said, if instead of being a 75% cap on production tax, what happens if it's a 70% cap? What happens if it's a 60% cap? What happens if it's a 50% cap? What happens if it's a 70% cap at any of the prices that we're looking at here, which go up to 230, is almost no difference whatsoever. And that's because the 75% cap itself really only binds at those sorts of high price levels. So in fact, I think the 75% cap binds somewhere in the 300s. The 70% cap binds somewhere in oil prices around the 220, 230 mark. So there was a very slight decrease, I think probably from 83 to 82% in the $230 case, and that's the only impact in terms of what's being measured here of a reduction in cap from 75 to 70%.
I think it's important to focus on what you said about the 75% cap. I guess if you could repeat that, approximately what oil price that translates to?
To give you a precise number, I'd need to do the math again, but it's somewhere in the 300s. If we reduce that cap to 60%, we start to see more of an impact. Then somewhere around the $160 mark, progressivity is capped and we see a relatively neutral structure from that point forward. If we take that down to the 50% mark, progressivity is really capped more around the $100, $110 mark, and we see a relatively neutral structure from that point forward. Similarly, if we look at this in our probabilistic approach, we see again those straight lines coming up on our graph as we reach the cap on production tax. And again, relatively speaking, increased expected values on the higher oil side as a result. So finally, and I apologize, I've, since these slides are submitted, added just one more, which is on the screen but not in your decks, just to put a few points up in regard to conclusions. Just to say, in terms of the material that we have covered today, we see a wide range of forms of progressivity in different parts of the world, and a wide range of metrics on which it can be based. Sometimes progressivity can be used to counterbalance the inherently regressive elements of a regime, things like a royalty component. And certainly, it seems to me from my analysis, and it sounded also from Senator Stedman's comments earlier, like PPT as it was originally proposed, was very much a system that had enough progressivity to counterbalance the other regressive elements in the regime, but to go no further. Other times, in other places in the world, we see progressivity applied in a way that's about deliberately taking as large a share of economic rent as possible, that there may be merits to doing so, but that they also need to be constrained by consideration of what that does, even if it can be done in a way that's entirely efficient, what that does to competitiveness. One can have a well-designed and highly progressive regime that is very efficient, but again, one needs to come back to the question of how competitive it is. Alaska, as we've seen, is one of the more progressive regimes in the world, and relatively speaking, at least based on the assumptions that we've seen, has a relatively high level of government take. In the OECD, only Norway has a higher level, and at $140 oil, it's about equal to Norway. And that the higher government take regimes tend to be PSC regimes in some of the higher take parts of the world. As we've seen, PPT, as was proposed, was a progressive component that counterbalanced other regressive elements to create a fairly neutral regime. Progressively, to pardon the pun, as time has gone on, the regime has become more and more progressive, more focused on capturing higher amounts of economic rent at higher prices, and less simply at creating a neutral regime.
Seeing that there's no further questions, we do thank Janik and Tony very much for the presentation over the last 2 days. We know a lot more now than we did 2 days ago, so I thank you very much for your participation, but at the moment we're going to take a brief at ease and we're going to transition into the next phase of the discussion. So, brief at ease.
What capex? What number are these?
This continuation of resources February 17th. It's 4 after 5. There'll be no hearings today on HB 144 and HB 185 that were listed. We're trying to reshuffle our schedule. We're sliding things back as we go. But they're rescheduled until next Tuesday. And in all probability, we'll probably hold this bill until next Tuesday and then move it at that time if there's no objection or nothing comes forward. So we have before us now Senate Bill 176. This is the initial presentation of the bill. Has a referral next to finance. There's a draft CS for the legislation, and I'd ask for a motion on the draft CS.
Mr. Chair, I move that we bring CS for Senate Bill 176, identified as version /B, before this committee for purposes of discussion.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. And with that, I'd like to bring Margaret Dowling to the table, and she'll present the bill. And I'd also like the committee to notice that we have Don Bullock, the drafter of the bill, here in case we get into some particulars. Welcome, Don. Good to see you again.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Margaret Dowling. I'm staff to Senator Wilkin. Pardon me, Wagoner. Hard habits die. Hard to die. Wagoner. And thank you. I just want to take a moment and thank you for staying past your normal time to hear bills, and of course, particularly to hear this bill, SB 176. And online we have Joanna Bales, the Deputy Director from Division of Tax. If there are any questions, she's made herself available to the committee. And of course, also as the Senator already mentioned, Don Bullock here in the room to answer your questions. And we do have some testifiers I know that are anxious to speak also to the bill. I'd like to say what the bill does basically is it removes from the mining license tax sand and gravel operations, quarry rock operations, and marketable earth. And the reason for the bill is that it's an extremely cumbersome bill, not only for the state, but also to industry. For example, in the last 5 years, I took the averages, there was about $268,000 that were collected as tax revenue as a result of the mining license tax. And to collect that revenue, it took the Department of Revenue about $150,000 to collect that $268,000. So you can see there's very little return for the effort that the state expends. In addition, in FY 2011, we had 182 operations that were subject to the tax. That includes both sand and gravel operations and also quarry rock operations. And of that 182, only 17 were actually required to pay the tax. And that is largely because many of them are small operations, so they're serving their local communities, and they fall within an exemption of $40,000 for net taxable income. So they're really just simply too small to be required to pay the tax. It's cumbersome to the businesses. On the business end, they're finding that they have many products that they produce, different grades of aggregate, different grades of sand, concrete, concrete blocks, pit run, and the like. And for each one of those products, in order to comply with this tax, they have to track all of their expenses associated with each product. And sometimes you might have one expense that could be attributed to a number of different products, and their task then is to try to determine, well, which part of the expense is attributable to which product and allocated appropriately. So it gets fairly complex, and there's therefore quite a bit of record keeping. In fact, you have a letter in your packets from CECON. I believe it's that letter where the comptroller says it takes about 200 hours a year to do the record keeping required to file a tax return and also to respond to audit requests. So they're, again, very cumbersome in time. If you have more than one pit, then you file a tax return and a schedule for each pit that you operate, again, adding to the time. And even if an operation is so small that it qualifies for that $40,000 net income exemption, they still must file a tax return and keep records. So that's why the burden of this tax is really pretty extraordinary relative to the actual tax revenue that is generated. I also like to point out that there's about 60 to 80% of the material that comes out of the ground in Alaska goes into public works projects that serve state residents and local communities. So what's happening is basically the state ends up paying on both sides of the equation. They pay to collect the tax, they incur the cost to collect the tax, and then on the flip side, as a consumer, they end up paying for the tax again, and in addition, the overhead portion that these companies are having to add to the price of their materials, we're paying for that as well. So we're kind of paying out of both sides.
What was the percentage there? I was listening, but it didn't hit me.
Sure. It's about 60 to 80%.
60 to 80, okay. 60, I'm glad I asked. Thank you. 60 to 80.
Thank you for the question through the chair. And that comes from some of the testifiers. I believe there might be someone online who can speak to that. I also wanted to just go through and explain why did we decide, in addition to sand and gravel operations, to exclude marketable earth, and also why did we exclude quarry rock, and I just want to take a moment to explain that. As I said, Joanna Bales is online, and she could also speak to that point. The reason we excluded marketable earth was to address a Department of Revenue and industry concern that once we took out sand and gravel, that some day distant down the future, there would be some regulator or some member of the public who would see marketable earth and wonder, does that include sand and gravel? So just to eliminate that potential confusion, we're taking it out. And again, Joanna can speak to this, but my understanding is that there are no tax returns filed under Marketable Earth. So it's not going to cause any harm. In addition, the reason we excluded Quarry Rock, you know, frankly, there's just too few of them. There's only, in the last 5 years, only 4 to 6 companies have filed tax returns under that Quarry Rock designation. So to keep it in would be not, certainly not achieve the efficiencies that we're trying to achieve with this legislation. So that concludes my remarks. I'm happy to answer any questions you have. And again, I really want to thank you for the time you're taking to hear this bill.
Any questions? Senator Wilcox.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for coming by the office to help to really clarify. I support the general concept of the bill. My only concerns, and thank you for addressing them, is the marketable earth. And we've heard a lot in the last couple of years about rare earth minerals, and I just want to be absolutely certain that we're not removing those sort of things from this definition by taking out the definition of marketable earth. So, Mr. Chair, I assume we'll have someone from the tax division.
Joanna Bales is on, and did you hear the question, Joanna?
Yes, Chair. For the record, my name is Joanna Bales. I'm the Deputy Director of the Tax Division. And through the Chair, Senator Wilikowski. Right now, our understanding in the way that we've administered this tax is marketable earth includes things such as peat, topsoil, clay. We did have Department of Law kind of look at the rare earth elements or minerals and determine whether or not that would cause a problem. And to be honest with you, we're not really sure that those types of elements are even covered under the mining license tax. So that is one issue there. The other is that rare earth elements, unlike the marketable earth, such as peat and topsoil, those are locatable minerals. And so we might... I mean, that is an issue. It's a good point to bring up, but we really don't think that excluding the marketable earth will affect that. But it will have to be a conversation and some research that we're going to have to do in the future if those rare earth elements start to be produced.
Senator Wilkowski.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would suggest this is a conversation we probably need to have now if we're removing it from our tax structure, quite frankly. If I know how hard it is to change tax structures, and if we would have a change somewhere down the line and someone were to discover a rare earth mineral or started to mine at length rare earth minerals, which we know are extremely valuable, we are potentially excluding them and from our tax structure. And I know my personal preference would be to just get this definition clarified. Like I said, I support the concept of exempting sand and quarry rock and gravel. I think it's a very reasonable proposal. I just want to make sure we're not going far beyond that by mistake, and I'm not feeling real confident after hearing that last answer from Revenue.
Any further statement, Joanna?
Mr. Chairman. Yeah, and I think it's a valid concern. I mean, if you do look at, though, the way the statutes are constructed right now, I mean, the definition of mining means any operation by which valuable metals, ores, minerals, asbestos, gypsum, I mean, so it would be something we should take a look at, and we'll do that immediately, as to whether or not those rare earth elements would fit under the valuable metals, ores, and minerals, because it probably would be identified as minerals, but I will consult with Department of Law immediately on that.
Would you do that? We're probably going to hold this bill until next Tuesday, and we'll address that issue at that time. Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And likewise, I think it's it makes sense. I'm looking at the bill makes sense. I'm looking at the fiscal note, Ms. Bales, and looking at page 2 in the narrative section, and I'm down in the expenditure narrative, and it says that the department has spent $150,000 each fiscal year examining and auditing sand and gravel tax returns. I just have to ask, why given the very, very small number of licensees paying tax, and why, given the extremely small amount of tax expended, are you spending that much on audits?
Through the chair, Senator French, that is what we've expended over the last 5 years. And one of the issues that came up back in 2006, we were contacted by the Madanuska Susitna Borough regarding several sand and gravel operators that could not get permits with the Matsu Borough because they didn't have the state's mining license. And at that point, we realized that we had a significant number of sand and gravel operators who were actually not in compliance. So we spent the last 5 years bringing a couple of hundred sand and gravel operators into compliance. And if you look under the revenue portion of that fiscal note on the same page, you'll notice that in 2007 we only had 11 licensees, and in 2011 we had 189. So we brought into compliance about 170 taxpayers, and the resulting tax was negligible. And until we did that exercise, we had no idea. But most of those sand and gravel operators were small operators who, because of the $40,000 exemption, didn't pay tax. And through audits and that compliance activity was when we discovered that this really isn't worth our time, and we have actually already started moving our resources back to the programs from which they came, because we did divert resources from other excise tax programs to help with this, and realized that, yeah, it wasn't really worth the time that we spent.
Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Dowling. And from there, we're going to go to public hearings. We have four people who wish to testify. The first is Tony Johansson. Are you on
there? Yes.
Go ahead.
For the record, my name is Tony Johansson. I'm a partner in the Fairbanks-based civil contractor Great Northwest Incorporated and the current AGC of Alaska President. Mr. Chairman and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 176 this afternoon. Early last year, my company received a two-page audit request from the Department of Revenue concerning our sand and gravel sales. The request listed 19 detailed sets of information and data needed to perform an audit of our mining license tax for the years 2008 and 2009, paperwork that would take our office manager weeks to assemble. In frustration, I contacted John McKinnon, the executive director of the AGC of Alaska. After doing its own research, the AGC approached the Department of Revenue last summer about the problems with the present tax as it applies to quarry rock and sand and gravel operations, and how the present requirements could be improved. The AGC came looking for a simpler solution to the tax calculation and audit process. After researching the revenue and the cost of collection, the administration recommended that the simplest and best solution was to exempt quarry rock and sand and gravel operations from the mining license tax requirements. We all quickly recognized that this is a true nuisance tax. For the state, it produces little revenue, if any, over the cost of administration. For the construction industry, it is a very complicated to calculate and even more complicated to audit. The revenue generated for the state of Alaska is a small percentage of the expense to industry and ultimately the public. When you consider that the majority of the mined and processed product goes into public works projects, the government is paying most of the associated costs and the tax at the expense of Alaska's public infrastructure. What appears on the surface to be a self-serving piece of legislation for the benefit of the construction industry really does have a broad public benefit. I appreciate your time and your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johansson. Is there any questions, Mr. Johansson? Seeing none, the second person, always had trouble with the names and end and a vowel. Mr. Matt Contini?
Hello. Mr. Chairman, my name is Mark Contini. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
I'm a professional civil engineer that represents about 10 gravel pits in the Matanuska Susitna Borough. I'm also the vice president of the Alaska Rock Products Association. I'm also a vice president of a gravel screening business. We operate in multiple pits in the Matsu Valley. I also own a pit personally that receives gravel royalties from a company that operates in our pit. I see we're running out of time tonight. I want to make my presentation very brief. And it's simple. The small gravel pit owners and small gravel pit screening business, working with those, I can tell you that the mining tax regulation is broken, and I would ask that you fix it. The simple way to state this, of the gravel pits that I work with, in the past decade, none of these have ever paid a penny to the state of Alaska for mining taxes. So I concur with the presenter earlier provided. I guess I would ask that you fix the regulations for us by exempting it. I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of this committee, for taking the time to investigate these adverse regulations. I'm available for questions regarding this negative impact on the small operators.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions?
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. Next, we'll go to Ben Simmons.
Hi. For the record, my name is Ben Simmons. I'm Vice President and Controller for Anchored Sand and Gravel. I've been in this capacity for 37 years. I have extensive experience with the mining license tax, both filing the tax returns, complying with the regulation, and responding to audits. I echo most everything that previous presenters have said. The statute is very ambiguous as it pertains to sand and gravel. For the most part, the other metals and minerals that are covered by the statute is gold, silver, zinc, lead, so forth. Gold is gold, silver is silver. Sand and gravel can be anywhere upwards of 20 to 40 products. Anchored Sand and Gravel currently produces and stocks between 20 and 40, and complying with the current audit requirements of controlling cost by product and determining what the fair market value of each of those products is very cumbersome. It's time-consuming, requires a lot of data and a lot of paper. The tax is inconsistent as it's applied to sand and gravel producers because each producer is different. If you're a supplier like Anchored Sand and Gravel, where approximately 70% of our production is sold to third parties and 30% used internally, as compared to, say, a general contractor where approximately 30% of their product may be sold to third parties, 70% used internally for their large construction jobs, either buildings, roads, or so forth. When you calculate the average sales price for each of those products, you can get a different price from one supplier or one producer to another, and that in turn will generate a different tax for the exact same products. As I mentioned, it is very burdensome. I just completed an audit for tax years 2005-2006. It took us upwards of 15 to 18 months to complete that audit, and I estimated our cost at something north of $50,000 to comply with requests, hold meetings with the auditing, with the auditors, and so forth. And as been mentioned several times, the amount of taxes that are collected compared to the cost and the net revenue to the state is negligible. And I strongly support, AS&G strongly supports Senate Bill 176. And thank you for your time, and I can answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Simmons. Any questions, Mr. Simmons? Thank you very much for your testimony. Last, we go to Cheryl Schaefer from Anchor Point.
Good afternoon. And for the record, I'm Cheryl Schaefer, and I'm one of the family members that owns Dibble Creek Rock. And I think I'm just going to reiterate what everybody's been saying, but we run a small family sand and gravel and a ready mix business here on the Lower Peninsula, Kenai Peninsula, and we do find it a burdensome to apply to the mining tax because our it's a complex situation between the different pits that we own. I have to file a double mining tax for each piece of property that we own that has a gravel pit on it, simply because the property is in our family name and the pit is operated by our company, Dibble Creek. And we're currently being audited by the Department of Revenue for 3 years of past mining taxes, and this audit's been going on since 2009. And I've spent weeks, me personally, on supplying information and answering questions during this time. And we only have a two-person office to maintain our daily work. So it certainly has become a burden. And again, the DOR and the department and our company find it difficult to separate out the mining activities from our integrated activities. And more time is actually spent on trying to comply with filing the correct mining tax return than it does for me to fill out our corporate tax return. Our company strongly supports the passage of Senate Bill 176, and I just thank you for your time, since it's past Friday and it's 5:30 in the afternoon, for listening to the problems of a small gravel operator here on the peninsula. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Schaefer. I appreciate your testimony. You know, and I just want to add, this is an opportunity that every politician looks forward to, being able to take something off the books instead of putting something on the books. So hopefully we can comply with that this year. Are there any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you coming out and testifying.
Okay.
With that, there's no further testimony at this time. Is there anybody here in Juneau that wishes to testify? Seeing none, I'm going to close public hearing. And since we're going to wait for some information to come back on the rare earth minerals, we'll hold this bill and we'll address it next Tuesday when we take the others up. With that, meeting's adjourned.